Hello, I'm very pleased to welcome you all today to the third Alistair Barclay Memorial Lecture and the seminar which will take place tomorrow. This seminar has been organised by the Development Studies Institute here at LSE and it happens every 2 years. The lecture is part of a series on aspects of law and development and was conceived as a memorial to Alistair Barclay. Alistair was 29 years old when he was killed in the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie in 1988 on his way to spend Christmas with his parents, who were then living in New York. He had originally studied architecture at Bristol, and after a period in Bangladesh, he took a law degree at Cambridge and then went to Uganda, where he taught for a time at the University of Makerere. He returned to the UK and took an LLM here at LSE. When he was killed, he just completed his first term as a lecturer in law at the Polytechnic of Central London, now the University of Westminster, and I understand that some of his students will be in the audience today. His attitude to life was very influenced by the time he spent working in Bangladesh and also at Makerere. And these experiences led to a strong commitment to the pursuit of popular justice, particularly for the poor. And it was this in mind that his parents decided to inaugurate a series of lectures and seminars, and we're very grateful to them for that. This year, the seminars and the lecture will be on land tenure and neural reform, with a focus on Africa. And I'd like to draw your attention to the fact that there will be a seminar going on all day tomorrow, with sessions on South Africa, Namibia, Rwanda, and also general issues on land reform, with papers given by academics and by policymakers, and everybody is very welcome to attend. It starts at 9:15. In the morning, the seminar will take place in room A144, and in the afternoon, in room A160, and both of those rooms are here in the main building. I'm now very pleased to welcome Ashwani Seth, who is the director of Development Studies Institute, to say a few words, and welcome Patrick McCausland, our speaker. Thank you.
Thank you. Time presses. It's a pleasure to kick off this program. It's a very rich program for tomorrow. It has been organized. And I think it gets off to a very fine start today, and it's a pleasure to introduce Professor Patrick McCausland, who's a professor in the Department of Law at Birkbeck College. He's previously taught at the London School of Economics, and until 1992, Professor of Public Law. He's had a long-term interest in constitutional land and environmental issues, been a high-level advisor to Habitat in Nairobi, extensive interest in African affairs, including close involvement in the Somalia project, exploring constitutional alternatives for Somalia, is something for the European Union. And most recently, something ongoing, a very deep involvement with the formulation of Tanzanian land laws. And I think that's what Patrick is very deeply involved in at this time. The title of his lecture is a little different from what you have on the green sheets, which have been distributed. The title is Making Law Work, Restructuring Land Relations in Africa. Patrick, welcome, you have the floor.
I think it's proper that this lecture should start by paying tribute to Mr. and Mrs. Barclay and by recalling the memory of Alistair. Alistair was one of my students, and we shared interests in and memories of Uganda, where he had worked. Occasionally, when doing so, come into contact with one or two of my former Ugandan students, my then senior lawyers in Uganda, whom I had taught in Dar es Salaam. I was fortunate to have Alistair in my class, as he was always a source of good ideas and good humour. And Uganda was, I think, fortunate that he chose to work there for a spell. I think we are all fortunate and deeply appreciative of the generosity of Mr. and Mrs. Barclay in endowing this lecture and seminar in the memory of Alistair. It is an extraordinarily imaginative initiative, creating an occasion, now I think an institution, for people to come together and exchange ideas about important issues of law and development. There are no shortage of such issues, but there are too few occasions for people from South and North to come together to discuss them. I'm greatly honoured to have been asked to give the Alistair Berkeley Memorial Lecture this year, which leads into the seminar tomorrow, and I hope that what I have to say does justice to the memory of Alistair. In this lecture, I intend to explore some issues concerning the appropriate role for the law to play in the restructuring and reform of land relations and land tenure in Africa. For several reasons, this is a highly relevant issue to examine at this time, and in seeking to examine it, I shall draw on my own experiences and involvement in land law reform in various countries in Africa, as well as other sources of information. I will first consider some of the reasons why the issue I have posed is a relevant one at this time. These reasons may be broken down into internal and external ones. Considering first the external ones, the two interlinked reasons may be noted. First, the twin emphasis by donors, led by the World Bank, on good governance and the market economy as the keys to social and economic regeneration in Africa, is increasingly seen as necessitating a greater reliance on legal forms and a legal culture similar to that operating in Western market-oriented economies, and thus conscious moves to adapt legal and judicial systems to that end are part of aid programs. Second, land reform, while never off the African reform agenda as advanced by the African community, is itself increasingly presented as being a candidate for legal, i.e. Western-type, legal solutions. And one can instance this some of the comments made in the seminal World Bank report, Sub-Saharan Africa, From Crisis to Sustainable Growth, and equally by Jean-Philippe Plateau's book on land reform and structural adjustment in Sub-Saharan Africa, Controversies and Guidelines. And if you look at what those two documents have to say, we find that whether the argument is for an unregulated free market in land, which the World Bank, of course, argues for, or a regulated and guided market, which Jean-Philippe Plateau argues for, the means to achieve these ends is seen as involving the introduction of new codes of land law. The internal reasons are equally, if not more, significant. I will concentrate here on events and countries in Eastern and Southern Africa with which I am most familiar. In December 1991, the inaugural International Conference on Planning Law in Africa took place in Maseru, Lesotho. It brought together planners and lawyers with an interest in planning and land matters from most countries in Eastern and Southern Africa, with a few outsiders to exchange ideas and experiences on the role of law in land use management. It was agreed at the end of the conference that a second one should be convened in 2 years' time, at which countries would report back on the extent to which they had complied with the conclusions and resolutions adopted at the instant conference. A second conference was duly held at Windhoek, Namibia in 1993, and again the same conclusion was reached. Now, it is easy to be cynical about such conferences, but this series is, I believe, different. I attended the first conference and the third, which took place in Johannesburg in May 1995. The first conference seemed to me to be a serious attempt to grapple with practical issues of the implementation of the law. What struck me very forcibly at the third conference was the peer group pressure to produce results. Delegates from country after country reported on either new laws recently introduced or planned on land management, or new policies adopted which would in time lead to new laws. There seemed to be a commitment to take planning and land law reform seriously, sparked off not by external pressure from donors, but by the internal pressures not to be thought to be lagging behind one's colleagues in the conference. The second internal reason is interlinked with the first. Quite apart from the impetus generated by the international conference, land reform of one sort or another through the medium of law is high on the agenda of many countries in Eastern and Southern Africa, and some examples may briefly be noted. Land reform and redistribution is a central thrust of the reconstruction and development policies of the government of the Republic of South Africa, and a large number of new and far-reaching laws have already been enacted to translate policy into action. I will return to these laws later. Land reform and redistribution has been a major issue in Namibia, both before and since independence, though little urgency has been shown in tackling the matter. However, significant legislative moves were taken in 1995 which may presage action on the ground. Tanzania undertook, via a presidential commission, a major investigation into the manifold deficiencies of existing policies and practices on land management, and proceeded thereafter to formulate new policies on land in the first half of the 1990s, and is now engaged in the exercise of turning the new national land policy, adopted by Parliament in June 1995, into law. In all these countries, the pressure to act was, at least in part, the result of contested democratic politics and the perceived need to meet the concern of rural voters. This is most obviously evident in South Africa, but the situation in Namibia and Tanzania may also be noted. The commitment to legislate in Namibia was made just before, and the enactment of the Agriculture Commercial Land Reform Act took place just after the general election of late 1994, when the government felt the need to respond to a People's Conference on Land Reform, which took place in 1994. In Tanzania, the setting up of a presidential commission and the drive towards finalising a national land policy took place during the same period as the country moved from a one-party to a multi-party political system, and NGO pressures persist to move forward on land issues. I think, however, that the commitment to developing a legal response to land reform, to see land reform as being in part land law reform, is driven by something else, an aspect of land reform not generally noted by external commentators and the aid industry pressing for land reform. Again, the South African case may be used. In South Africa, during the era of apartheid, indeed from 1913 onwards, there was a plethora of legislation on land tenure so far as it affected Africans. The principal characteristic of this legislation was that it deprived Africans of any rights to land and any security of title and put them at the mercy of administrative whim. Law was used to abolish law. Land reform in South Africa, then, must include land law reform because it seeks to change the nature of the legal regime, the legal culture that applied to African-held land. It is to substitute rights guaranteed by law for, at best, licenses or permits at the mercy of law. The same approach to African land tenure was adopted in pre-independence Namibia, which may not come as much of a surprise, but equally, as is graphically portrayed in the Presidential Commission on Land Matters, it was also a feature of the post-independence land administration practices in Tanzania. There, the pre-independence colonial approach of denying that Africans had any rights in the land was the foundation of Operation Vijiji, the forced and illegal collectivization of peasants in the 1970s. When, in the more open political system that began to develop in Tanzania in the late 1980s, peasants began to seek judicial redress for what they argued was the deprivation of their land during the collectivization, the government rushed legislation through the National Assembly to stop all judicial proceedings on land issues. It then sought to defend the constitutionality of the legislation before the Court of Appeal in Attorney General and Akane in 1994, 33 years after independence, by solemnly arguing through the Deputy Attorney General that those persons who held their land by customary law, under what are known in Tanzanian land law as deemed rights of occupancy, did not have a property right in the land, and so were not protected by the constitutional provision against deprivation of property without compensation. As the Chief Justice pointed out, the effect of this argument was that, and I quote, most of the inhabitants of Tanzania are no better than squatters in their own country. It is a serious proposition. The court rejected the proposition, and with it, the foundation of Operation Vijiji, that land could be taken without payment of compensation. Legislation now being drafted to implement the national land policy will make very clear that all citizens in Tanzania, whatever the legal origin of their rights of occupancy, the highest form of landholding right available in Tanzania, have a property right in the land held for right of occupancy and are thus protected by the Constitution. So in Tanzania, land reform is preeminently land law reform, the substitution of a law to facilitate the right of citizens to access and hold land for a law which facilitated the state's administrative control over the citizens' access to land. Two sets of pressures, then, are operating on policymakers in Africa to use the law to restructure land relations. These pressures, however, point in opposite directions. the external pressures point in the direction of facilitating the operation of a market for land. Some, at least, of the internal pressures point in the direction of strengthening the security of tenure for those on the land at present. As may be imagined, it is not always easy to reconcile these two sets of pressures, since facilitating a market in land must necessarily involve weakening the rights of existing landholders to retain their land. Left out of the equation so far is the third pressure applying to land restructuring, one which is certainly present in Tanzania and Namibia, and which it would be surprising if it were not present in South Africa in some form or other. This is the pressure for the status quo, for using law to bolster the existing arrangements rather than to change them. A new law is for public relations, not for public actions. Thus, in Namibia, the land reform law has triggered off a significant difference of opinion between two, if not three, sets of officials and politicians. First, those who argue that economic development and a healthy foreign exchange position require that the status quo of very large, white-owned cattle ranching be maintained and very minimal changes be made to accommodate land-hungry Africans from the north of the country. Second, those who argue that the evidence shows that African smallholders are in fact very efficient farmers and that the Land Reform Act should be implemented and land acquired from the cattle ranchers to settle African smallholders on the land. And finally, those who see the Act as an opportunity to facilitate land grabbing in the more fertile lands in the north. Those displaced by land grabbing can be compensated by land acquired from ranchers under the Land Reform Act. Thus, attempts to revise the Land Reform Act to close its loopholes, to develop criteria and administrative arrangements in order to facilitate its implementation, are hardly just a technical matter for legal and other consultants to deal with. At one level they are, but at another level, the issue is one of whether to use the Act to start the process of significant societal transformation for which the 30-year War of Independence was waged, or whether to underuse the Act to maintain existing land relations with some cosmetic changes, the preferred option of some international agencies, or whether to misuse the Act to allow the new elite to join the ranks of large-scale landowners, the preferred option of some, at least, of the new elite. The Namibian case, however, does highlight one important point. To move from policy formulation to drafting laws is not, as some people assume, to move from a debate on policy to one on legal technicalities. The move changes the content of the debate, but it remains a policy debate. In some respects, indeed, it becomes a sharper and more relevant debate. The broad general policies set out in, for instance, the Tanzania government's national land policy or the Namibia government's land reform to promote equity and fairness can be readily agreed to by everyone, or almost everyone. Who, after all, could possibly be against equity and fairness? But when these ideas are turned into precise powers, duties, limitations, restrictions, procedures, when it becomes clearer who is to benefit and who is to lose, then objections begin to be voiced. Naturally, not objections on policy grounds, but on technical legal grounds. Such and such a clause wouldn't work. Another provision is unnecessary. Yet another goes too far or is impractical. Sometimes, as happened in Namibia, the argument is advanced that as the law, in that case the Land Reform Act, is so deficient, perhaps it would be better if its implementation were postponed until it was rectified, so allowing yet more time for the loopholes in the Act to be exploited and the policy promoting equity and fairness to be further undermined. The conclusion that may be drawn thus far is that every step of the way down the legal path involves policy. The decision to resort to law, the nature of the legal system to be adopted, the style of the law, the sources of the law, the content of the law. All these decisions are policy decisions. And there's nothing particularly original in making these points. They are worth making, however, since in the context of development and aid, these points are often denied, explicitly or implicitly, and law is portrayed as the technical and relatively uncontentious means whereby policy can be implemented. Not too surprisingly, this approach is a feature of the World Bank publication, the World Bank and Legal Technical Assistant, which states that, I quote, the bank should ensure that its legal assistance projects are in accordance with its policy of non-interference in the politics of its member countries. At the same time, however, and I quote, In the light of the close linkage between economic and legal reforms, it is important that any assistance to the borrowing country's legal reforms should be part of the bank's country assistance strategies that identify reform priorities in a range of areas. The bank does not vouchsafe how the latter statement is to be reconciled with the former. The business of drafting, then, of turning broad policy statements about land, which may well contain deliberate ambiguities and contradictions, into more precise implementable propositions of law is a policy function, a political matter. For the remainder of this lecture, I want to explore some of the problems of drafting land laws in a policy framework, that is, to discuss drafting as politics, to discuss some of the choices that confront the draftsperson that rarely get much public debate. The first matter which may be addressed is the fundamental one of the extent to which it is realistic to use a major and inevitably complex piece of legislation such as a new code of land law as a vehicle of radical social reform. Is there not a danger that the act of legislating, the detailed, complex verbal formulae put before legislators, the minutiae of debate on those details, the need for officials and citizens alike thereafter to master the new rules and comply with them, the inevitable slow-moving bureaucracy which clings like and like to any new reform programme, the politics of reform already noted in, e.g. the Namibian case, will dull the edge of reform. Far better, if one is serious about reform, to get out and do it and let the law catch up later. This was the Tanzanian way with Operation Vijiji, where what little law there was largely ignored. Law was, and to some extent still is, perceived in Tanzania as an impediment to change. So the style of drafting has tended to be one of conferring great powers on officials, with few safeguards and external controls. This ambivalence about law is well brought out in the report of the Presidential Commission and the ongoing debate about the drafting of a new national land law. Two of the most important proposals in the report are these. First, villagers should be able to obtain individual customary rights of occupancy to land. That is, the process of individualisation of land tenure should be officially recognised and assisted forward in Tanzania. The rather tricky business of determining boundaries of individual plots and who may claim what rights in the land about to be individualised would be dealt with, and I quote, in the manner traditionally accepted in the village in the presence of members of the village council, with disputes to be settled by the baraza. The revolutionary proposals of individual titles to land was accepted and forms part of the national land policy. Second, it was proposed that the basic dispute settlement mechanism for village land should be baraza ya wazee ya ardi, councils of village elders. These bodies would have original jurisdiction in all land matters, including settling disputes over individualisation of tenure. They would determine their own procedures, subject to the obligation to follow the principles of natural justice, would not be bound by any civil or criminal procedure codes, or the law of evidence, or have lawyers appearing before them. Mbaraza, too, had been largely accepted by the national land policy, which is, however, silent on practice and procedures. Now, both these far-reaching proposals involve changes in the law, but the clear message of the Presidential Commission was that the new law would be similar to that which it would replace in terms of drafting style. A few broad strokes of the legal pen, giving vast powers to totally unqualified people and relying on their innate common sense and sense of justice to get things done. Just like Operation Vijiji, in fact. In the light of the evidence uncovered by the Presidential Commission of the abuse of power and the chaos that accompanied that exercise, the word naivety comes to mind to describe this approach. This might be unfair. A better analysis is that the approach adopted by the Commission is a classic example of the operation of path dependency. Let me quote a brief passage from Douglas North's Institutions, Institutional Change and Economic Performance on Path Dependency. Once a development path is set on a particular course, the network externalities, the learning process of organisations, and the historically derived subjective modelling of the issues reinforces the course. We cannot understand today's choices without tracing the incremental evolution of institutions. Applied to land and the use of law to alter land relations in Tanzania, this tells us that while the policy proposals of the Presidential Commission were indeed far-reaching, the approach to the use of law to implement them was driven, to some extent, by long-standing Tanzanian legal traditions. The real revolutionaries, therefore, might turn out to be not those who propose radical policies, but those who, in the national land policy, propose a radical legal methodology for implementing policies, namely a detailed and inevitably lengthy new land code in which legal rules and checks and balances replace reliance on administrative and political action based on goodwill and common sense, on the evidence in short supply where land relations are concerned. In addition to Tanzania, South Africa is a country which has clearly decided that a major programme of detailed land law reform is the key to the radical reform of land relations. And the Green Paper on South African Land Policy, Our Land, sets out the case for this. The Green Paper lists four acts and four bills as part of the legislative programme to implement land reform. And many of these laws have established, or are proposing to establish, judicial institutions as key parts of the implementing mechanisms. In contrast to Tanzanian statutes, South African statutes are very detailed and tend therefore to be lengthy. The philosophy behind this seems to be that the detail in the law will facilitate radical action rather than hinder it. If powers and the reasons for them are spelt out clearly, then officials will be able to take and justify actions. Here too, we can see path dependency at work. One of the most striking characteristics of the imposition and operation of apartheid in South Africa was the use of law. Immensely detailed and complex bodies of law designed to entrench and settle in a fixed and permanent way a specific social and economic system. Law, in a painstaking and detailed form, was the primary tool used to create and implement apartheid. And now, through the Constitution and the Land Reform Programme, the same type of law and manner of lawmaking is a primary tool to dismantle it. I find myself to be much more in tune with the South African approach and philosophy to legislative drafting. I can give three reasons why. First, on the evidence very clearly set out in the Tanzanian presidential report, officials armed with powers subject to few or no restraints cannot be trusted to behave reasonably. They cannot always be trusted to behave reasonably where they are subject to some restraints. The old South Africa is evidence to that. But at least where there are legal rules and procedures which have to be followed, a challenge can be mounted to unreasonable behaviour. Even in the old South Africa, particularly as regards land and housing, the courts did, quite frequently, by a close and technical interpretation of a statute, rein back an unreasonable exercise of power. And because the decision was based on the interpretation of a statute, it was hard to allege that the judges were interfering in policy, a charge which it is more plausible to make where the statute is very broad and some general principles of administrative law are used to overturn an administrative decision. This brings me to my second reason, one of considerable moment in much land reform in Africa, where, as is the case in much of Africa, the allodial title to land is vested in the state, or in the president, as in Tanzania, or the king, as in Lesotho. So the citizen has to obtain land from the state, with state officials managing the land as landlords, or where the state reserves power to itself to bring about fundamental alterations in land relations among the citizenry, as in South Africa, Namibia, Zimbabwe, and Kenya, land law ceases to be a matter of private law. It becomes part of public law. It is, in fact, administrative law. It could be argued that over the last 20 or so years, no branch of the law, with the possible exception of environmental law, has developed more quickly or with such universal approbation as to its guiding principles than administrative law. Many of the newer generations of African constitutions, Malawi, Namibia, South Africa, Uganda, now explicitly provide for administrative justice to be part of the Bill of Human Rights. Administrative law or administrative justice require that official power be bounded by legal rules, be exercised in accordance with certain principles of fairness, allow for hearings and appeals, and be subject to review. How else can this be done except through statutory provisions which go beyond just granting powers to officials but provide for the manner of their exercise and control? I have found in my work in drafting the new land law for Tanzania that much of the draft is applied administrative law, even where the draft is dealing with such matters of substantive land law as remedies for breach of conditions in a right of occupancy or determining the rent for a right of occupancy. The manner of dealing with breaches or setting the rent involves principle of administrative law, because it would be public officials who would exercise the relevant powers. I have not felt able just to provide that powers will be exercised reasonably. I have followed what may be referred to as the South African model of spelling out in some detail how powers are to be exercised, on what basis, and taking account of what factors. In doing so, I have inevitably become involved in policy, since I have had to put into the bill substantive matters which are not dealt with in the national land policy. There will then be a double test which would have to be applied to any assessment of the draft. Does it create a new substantive land law apt for the conditions of Tanzania? And secondly, does it provide an appropriate legal framework for the exercise of powers by officials? The third reason is, for more rather than less law, is paradoxically perhaps the market reason. Administrative justice apart, a land law conferring broad powers with few controls on officials is fine when the main thrust of the law is about administrative power and there are few private rights to bother about. As you have seen, that was the position with respect to the land relations of the majority of the population of Tanzania right up to late 1994. But once the land law recognises private rights and facilitates dealing with those private rights in the marketplace, the law has to be much more specific and clear. The nature and limits of the private rights, how they may be acquired, disposed of, burdened, lost, the whole issue of third-party rights, and where the state is to remain involved, a more exact demarcation of state power, all have to be spelled out in detail so that those with private rights or intending to try and obtain private rights in the land can predict with reasonable certainty the scope and operation of the law applicable to those rights. It is no accident, for instance, that the National Land Code of Malaysia is composed of 494 sections and 14 schedules extending over 428 pages. Malaysia has a market economy, and the code sets out the basic land law of Malaysia, dealing both with private rights and their exercise, and with the powers of officials in a market economy. I would argue, then, that a detailed and necessarily somewhat complex land law is an inevitable part of moving towards a more market-oriented, private rights-based land law. Difficult though the transition will be for many people in e.g. Tanzania, Namibia, and South Africa, the alternative, a continuation of a relationship to land at the mercy of officials, cannot seriously be entertained. An excellent illustration of the dangers of a continued reliance on administration as opposed to law arose recently in Lesotho, in respect of the provisions relating to compensation for loss of land brought about by the Lesotho Highlands Water Project, a major dam building project. After a somewhat shaky start in the late 80s, the project had developed some good principles of compensation for loss of land and livelihood, although practice, it must be admitted, still lags behind. As part of the process of preparation of the next phase of the project, a major and excellent participative study has been undertaken of the compensation needs and desires of local people who will be displaced by the next phase of the project. The report of the study contains the statement, I quote, "The compensation policy of the Lesotho Highlands Development Authority has no legal status and cannot be cited in a court of law. It serves as a set of guidelines to assist LHDA in the implementation of its compensation programme." At a workshop in March to discuss the study, this statement was picked up and queried. What's the point of a study and a workshop if the Development Authority can just ignore what they are told? The consultant stated that they were just repeating what they had been told by the authority's legal officers. I was the only lawyer present at the workshop, and tried to reassure other participants, including representatives from the area concerned, by making reference to such concepts as legitimate expectations and reasonableness, that even if the proposed policies were not part of a statute, the authority could not ignore them, and a court would take account of them in any action challenging the authority's decisions. But the damage had clearly been done. Local people were dismayed by the statement, and many other persons present at the workshop had their already cynical view of the Development Authority reinforced. Lay people, both formally educated and otherwise, are well aware of the difference between having to rely on administrative goodwill and having rights enshrined in the law. A new landlord, then, is a necessary mix of public and private law for a mix of public, administrative, and private market reasons. Interestingly, this same point has been made recently and in more general terms by two Italian lawyers writing about property law reform in Eastern and Central Europe in a passage which is worth quoting. Ajani and Mattai, in Codifying Property Law in the Process of Transition, Some Suggestions from Comparative Law and Economics, state, and I quote, "In all modern legal systems, property law involves private law as well as a good deal of public law. Economists tend to disregard this point, but it is crucial for lawyers. Lawyers see private and public law as cooperating in defining property rights. Economists usually see private law as creating property rights and public law as destroying them. Indeed, in the standard neoclassical economic approach, private law is the province of the market, while public law is the province of the state. In more sophisticated economic terms, however, property law is justified as a cure of externalities. Each legal system will therefore establish, in addition to a private law cure, a more or less extended public law cure of externalities, reflected by a larger or smaller role of administrative regulation and enforcement. The crucial issue, as the authors go on to say, is to strike the right balance between public and private law for each problem. One particular problem is that of controls over dispositions. Should they be provided for, and if so, in what manner? The ambivalence about controls on market transactions is well brought out in the National Land Policy of Tanzania. On the one hand, there is a policy statement so clear it could almost have been drafted by the World Bank. The consent of the minister or his appointed officers is not necessary for market transfers to take place. On the other hand, there are numerous policy statements which equally clearly seek to regulate the process of market transfer. Again, I quote, "No disposition will be allowed unless all development conditions are being complied with. Regulations will be drafted to protect risk groups such as displaced persons, children, and lower income people. Special taxes will be imposed to deter land speculation. Land ceilings will be fixed by government. Land hoarding will be discouraged by strict enforcement of development conditions. And special rules will continue to apply to foreign investors." All these provisions are, in my view, perfectly reasonable. The problem for the draftsperson is how to reconcile the two approaches, the private law free market approach of no consent with the public law regulatory approach. In Namibia, until the enactment of the Land Reform Act, the dilemma had been resolved by imposing on an official established for the private law purpose of registering deeds relating to land transfers, the Registrar of Deeds, public law duties, of checking whether certain public law restrictions had been complied with before approving the registration of a deed. This has led to some considerable concern on the part of the registrar that her office is being misused. It cannot be a watchdog, in her view, for other departments and regulatory agencies, and this would change it from an agency which vetted private legal documents to ensure their conformity with the private law to advance essentially private transactions in the market to a judgmental agency concerned with public law matters. Under the Land Reform Act, while the role of the registrar as watchdog is continued, in addition, all transactions by settlers have to be approved by the minister, and as drafted, the Act provides no appeal from the refusal of a consent by the minister. This is clearly wildly impractical and would quickly lead to a situation where virtually every transaction was illegal, as people would not wait for and or would ignore an adverse ministerial decision on a transaction. My proposed solution in Tanzania, in respect of land transactions in land under the jurisdiction of central government, was to borrow an approach from English town and country planning law. The deemed consent for certain transactions and classes of transactions provided for by the Act, which could be expanded or contracted by ministerial order, together with some provisions requiring that consent be obtained for certain specific transactions. This did not find favour with a workshop held to review the draft. It was too complicated. Sweep all consents away. But that does not meet the policy prescription for some controls. In Kenya, a system of local land control boards was established many years ago. They do not work. In relation to village land in Tanzania, the village councils will be empowered to regulate transactions, but the problem of general administrative regulation remains. In the UK, regulation focuses on the institutions and personnel involved in market transactions rather than on the transactions themselves. Estate agents, solicitors, building societies are all now regulated via commissions, ombudsmen, the Office of Fair Trading and local authorities. But I do not think that that solution would work in most states in Africa, where the concern is to try and ensure that the introduction of a market in land does not lead to landlessness and indebtedness on one hand and to very large-scale landowners on the other. I do not see any way to avoid some regulatory mechanism which, in order to ensure consistency, fairness and transparency, will need to include a central appellate authority. This will be a departure from market mechanisms as they operate in Western economies, though not as they operate in East Asian market economies, where regulations on land transactions have long been a feature of land markets without seeming to inhibit their vigorous operation. In the space of 1 hour lecture, I cannot hope to cover all the legal and policy issues which confront a person drafting a land law reform. This lecture has to be selective, but one issue cannot be ignored. Probably the most challenging task facing any programme of land law reform in Africa is the issue of the place of customary law in any reformed law. The cause of customary law has waxed and waned over the years. Plateau quotes several World Bank studies and reports. She put the difficulties of improving African agriculture down to the defects of customary tenure, with the proposed solution being to move towards a modern individualised tenure system based on statute law. On the other hand, he also draws attention to alternative views that customary tenure cannot be ignored, but must be used as the basis for any reform programme. The latest statement of this, from what may be called the World Bank stable, is the Bruce Migot Adola study, edited study, Searching for Land Tenure Security in Africa, which concludes that, and I quote, we should be moving away from a replacement paradigm in which indigenous tenures are to be replaced by tenure provided by the state towards an adaptation paradigm. An adaptation paradigm requires a supportive legal and administrative environment for the evolutionary change in indigenous law. Such a supportive environment implies a clear recognition of the legal applicability and enforceability of indigenous land tenure rules. It should not be thought, however, that the policy of replacement was solely a donor-driven policy. Kenya's policy was certainly commenced by the colonial power in 1956, but has continued ever since independence, well over 30 years ago. Tanzania has constantly enacted legislation which purports to abolish customary law, the latest one being in 1992. These laws have not worked. In Kenya, which has the longest and arguably the most consistent customary land tenure replacement policy in Anglophone Africa, the enactment of the Land Disputes Tribunal Act in 1991 was a recognition that customary tenure could not be abolished. The Act established councils of elders to handle land disputes, applying customary law, even in those lands where rights have been adjudicated and are now governed, allegedly, by the Registered Land Act of 1962. I want to consider one or two issues in connection with customary law and statute law. First, the issue of women's rights to land. It must be said that approaches to tenurial reform have tended to skirt round this issue. Namibia's act enacted in 1995 is silent on the matter, as is the draft communal land bill enacted in the same year. Developments in Tanzania are more fluid and bring out well the ambivalence about doing anything specific on the subject. Women MPs in the National Assembly objected to the lack of specifics about women's rights when the National Land Policy was brought to the National Assembly last year, and were only persuaded to withdraw their objections to the policy by oral concessions to the effect that the Constitution requires that everyone be treated equally so that women would be treated equally in respect of land allocation under the National Land Policy. In fact, the Constitution's definition of discrimination does not include any reference whatsoever to gender discrimination, and indeed the chapter on the Bill of Rights starts off by asserting all men are born free and are all equal. More significantly, it was alleged by a woman who drafted the policy statement about women's rights in the National Land Policy that after the draft had been accepted, additional words were added which undid much of the thrust of what she had drafted. I have in my draft bill provided at various points that those concerned with the management of land should have special regard for the needs of women when considering allocational dispositions of land. The dispute settlement bodies located at village level, the Mbaraza, must include women in their composition. and that land adjudication in connection with individualization must pay particular attention to the interests of women. The workshop on the draft bought into these proposals without much enthusiasm. These provisions set the parameters for action, but for anything more, we'll have to turn to two other issues. The Tanzanian reforms, and even more so the South African reforms, which are much more advanced, I think, in connection with women's rights, throw up the issue of customary law and legislative intrusion into that law. The Presidential Commission in Tanzania played down the necessity, or even desirability, of significant statutory reform of customary land law, apart from provisions designed to prevent discrimination against women. It considered the reform of that law as best brought about by the slow process of judicial decisions, similar to the way that common law and equity involved in England. But we are not starting from a tabula rasa. In all countries, there have been legislative intrusions into customary law. In Tanzania for over 70 years, including several attempts to abolish it. The restoration of customary law, which the new Act will provide for, means the customary law will derive its legality, if not its legitimacy, from statute law in the future. Is this an example, perhaps, of the invention of tradition? The process of individualization of title poses the greatest challenge to the evolution of customary law. The creation of an individual customary right of occupancy and its allocation to an individual or group through a statutory process ipso facto breaks the link between the land and customary tenure, even if the same people occupy the land. The new law in Tanzania, however, will provide that the incidence of tenure of the new holding will be governed by customary law. This is a recognition that whatever legislation might say, in practice, customary law would continue to apply. The Act, however, will intrude further. Some basic rules of fair procedure are laid down. Property should not be taken away, or a penalty on misuse or some other infringement of customary tenure rules should not be applied without notice, and an opportunity to contest the matter at a hearing and a right of appeal are provided. Contentiously, the law will also provide that inter vivos transfers designed to prevent women from succeeding to or acquiring land might be disallowed. The justification for legislative intrusion is determined first by the constitutional principle of equal treatment, second by the principles of administrative justice, and third by the national land policy itself. Can and should legislative intrusion into customary law be minimized? Should more vigorous efforts be made to adapt it to the needs of the marketplace? To what extent can and should a conscious effort be made to develop a national customary law or common law via judicial decisions? These are not matters that are being considered in Tanzania's national land policy, in Namibia's policy documents, nor surprisingly, perhaps, in the South African Green Paper. I now turn to the last two points in what already is an overlong lecture, and these concern people, legal academics and the training of personnel. One of the most striking aspects of the wide-ranging public debate on land reform in South Africa over this decade has been the leading role taken by lawyers, for the most part legal academics, in writing about the need for and possible models for land reform laws. The quality of the legal contributions has undoubtedly raised the intellectual and conceptual content of the debate and are likely to contribute to better laws as a consequence. In Tanzania too, it was an academic lawyer who headed and in practice played a leading role in the Presidential Commission on Land Matters that has had such a powerful influence on the content of the national land policy. Concerned and committed legal scholarship and its publication matters. And I do not believe progress on land reform or land law reform can be made if it is absent in a country. Legal scholarship, however, is only one, albeit very important, role of the legal academic. New land laws providing for major programs of land reform will involve, must involve, major programs of training of those who are to implement the law and those who are to use them. New land laws may well be ignored by the people at large if they do not perceive any benefits to flow from complying with them. They are much more likely to adopt this attitude if no effort is made to explain the laws to them and show them how they may benefit from same. It seems to me that this is a major challenge to the legal profession as a whole, but particularly to the academic branch of it. It is also a challenge to the donor community who urge land law reform on countries in Africa. To give just one statistic, in line with the policies enunciated in the National Land Policy, considerable powers of land management are to be vested in village councils in Tanzania by the new law. There are approximately 7,000 villages in Tanzania. It is doubtful if 1% have any officials with any expertise in land management. Unless a quite extraordinary program of training in the new law and how to exercise the powers under that new law is mounted for village officials, aiming to do no more than provide one trained official per village, the law will never be effective and may in fact be counterproductive, as it will contribute to widening the gap of comprehension about land and law between the peasants on the one hand and central officials and the educated elite on the other. Such a program can only be mounted with donor support. Equally, to ensure that new specialized land courts in Mbarara are staffed by persons with some knowledge of the land laws of Tanzania would involve considerable resources. While donors might supply funds and some technical training expertise for these training programs, the intellectual and human resource input must come from inside the country concerned. Lawyers, and in particularly academic lawyers, then face two major challenges in respect of land law reform in Africa. First is the challenge of scholarship, to rise above the merely descriptive and analytical approach to writing about land law and adopt a more policy-oriented and innovative approach which offers new models and creative ideas as solutions to practical problems of land management. And if the opportunity presents itself, become involved in the challenging business of turning those ideas and models into legislative drafts. Let no one suggest that that is not a scholarly endeavour. Second is the challenge of education and training. Here too, there is a need to set aside the traditional, rather narrow function of the undergraduate legal educator. Innovative programmes of mass legal education, of the development of distance learning materials and instructions, of interactive learning via computer programmes, the use of radio, television and videos, and intensive short courses for all levels of officials and lawyers will need to be developed and taught. In sum, while land law reform might just still be the preserve of the lawyer, the products of that reform, the new laws, are the property of the nation, and the nation must be stimulated wholeheartedly to embrace those laws. Only in this way can the law be made to work to restructure land relations in Africa. Thank you.
I think we have time to take a few questions. Should there be some from the floor? Who has a question? James.
Yeah, based on my own research around agrarian reform, Philippines, Southeast Asia, one of the problems that comes out very clearly in this period, one of the problems that comes out very clearly in relationship to agrarian reform in Southeast Asia has been the experience of vesting decisional power in the courts around the land law, where it is legal systems constantly confront power. Power that's not codified in the same way as the law, but is nonetheless decisive in social relations. Now, one of the problems in past legislation on land has been the absence of vesting judicial authority in administrative bodies that implement reform. Now, I can imagine in Africa, which is a very different situation, different context, there's going to be great dispute in South Africa and Tanzania over the application of the new laws that you're talking about. And how do you balance and assess this problem of the interminable years, decades in which land cases drag on in the courts? How do you reconcile that with the obvious need, and I think the very well stated argument you've made about codifying land and land rights law in Africa?
I was running a bit short of time, so I cut out the two pages or so of my lecture dealing with dispute settlement in relation to land disputes in Africa. And you have to ask the one question that I didn't touch on. Well, yes, I won't go back and start lecturing again. But I think that, again, referring to the Presidential Commission in Tanzania, because I think in many respects that has done the best sort of overall study of land systems in Africa there's been for many years, indeed in the opinion of many people anywhere. And they recommended that there should be a specialized set of dispute settlement mechanisms set up, starting at the bottom with the Mbaraza, Yawezeyi-Ardi, the Council of Village Elders, right up to a specialized land court. And the national land policy bought into that, though they prefer to call them quasi-judicial bodies because they feel the word court suggests it'll be bureaucratic and slow, etc., etc., etc. I think the important thing is, and I very much agree with this provision, is that there should be specialized dispute settlement bodies leading up to a central, high-level specialized dispute settlement body, independent of the executive, properly staffed, with adequate and simple procedures. And the point I make, and going right back to your point, is that, in my view, is in too many countries in Africa, too little attention has been paid to dispute settlement mechanisms and to providing adequate resources for dispute settlement. So yes, in the case of Ghana, for instance, when I did some work in Ghana in the early 1990s, I was told there were 16,000 cases outstanding relating to land in Accra alone. And you could actually see the way Accra was being developed by virtue of those cases, namely vast areas of central Accra were left undeveloped. People were leapfrogging outside where they could buy land off the peasants and develop it easily because they didn't want to get involved in land disputes in relation to central Accra. So it has a major impact on land development. And of course, in Accra and also in Kenya, there have been land disputes which have led to considerable violence, leading up to, of course, to a total breakdown of civil society in a place like Rwanda, where land disputes have just brought the whole country to a total collapse. So I think, yes, there does need to be attention paid to dispute settlement mechanisms, and I think if the new land law is to work in Tanzania, it will only work if there is an effective system of dispute settlement starting at the village level, going up through the regions or districts and up to the centre, properly staffed, properly funded, able to decide decisions fairly quickly. And this, indeed, was one of the things, one of the messages the peasants were giving to the Presidential Land Commission, that they wanted to get away from the slow, and particularly they wanted to go away from the administrative tribunals, which they thought were very much part of the executive.
Yes, please.
What is your opinion on the current land law reforms going on in Africa, countries like Tanzania particularly, where law tends to favor the groups which are considered by the state to be economically viable, meaning that people like pastors or hunter-gatherers in this case are just left out of the new land law.
I think the problems of trying to draft something to deal with pastoralists is the most difficult task that a draftsman has. And indeed, on the draft that I had done and was discussed in March at a workshop, that this was one of the major criticisms made of the draft, that I hadn't grappled with that, and I hadn't. It's a terribly difficult task, and I've got to try and get down to it, and with the help of people in Tanzania, we will in the second round. I have to say that I think the national land policy is being a bit optimistic, I put it politely, by stating that nomadism will be abolished. I think that's a bit impractical, quite apart from its constitutionality. So we have to get down, and I think there is a real problem there. And I think part of the problem is that there haven't been adequate drafts. So the solution has tended to be abolish customary law. It applied the Range Development and Management Act of Tanzania. Customary law was abolished in 1964. In the case of individualization of tenure in Kenya, of course, once the land has been adjudicated, then it comes under the statutory system. But we know this doesn't work. So I don't think the solution is to try and abolish customary land tenure in relation to pastoralists. One has to try and provide for pastoralists in the same way as one does for agriculturalists, a mechanism whereby they can use the customary law, but this can slowly be adapted and adjusted. But easier said than done, I agree.
I think we have time for a question.
or one or two very brief interventions. I see two hands there, so you have one. Yes, then yourself, and then. Yes, that's you.
Oh, yes, of course, undoubtedly. If one takes the case of, say, the South African land reform program, I mean, they see the need for a whole raft of major program of land reform, dealing with redistribution and new rights and the like. And in Tanzania, too, I think any program of land reform also has to take on board, for instance, the reform of the laws relating to succession, the reform of laws relating to credit, and that will be part of the basic land law, and also environmental laws. And indeed, in Tanzania, the Law Reform Commission has recently produced a report on reform of the law of succession, and the National Environmental Council is itself working on developing new laws to deal with environmental management. So yes, I think one must see land reform and land law reform as part of a total package to deal with land and the environment. And I think this is the way Tanzania certainly is seeing it, and other countries in Africa too.
The last question.
The total package question is terribly important. Two of us in the audience had the privilege of being present at the workshop in Tanzania in March. And the problem that I think many of those who participated in identified was the conflict on the one hand.
Well, I would certainly accept that any new law, however long or short it is, must, before it actually comes into effect, must be preceded by some kind of training. I think it would be quite fatal to pass the law in October and introduce it in November when it hadn't even been printed, which, if that happened, it wouldn't be the first time it had happened in different countries. So I think there must be a program where people have a chance to be educated and understand the law before the laws is introduced, and it should be introduced in stages. There's no reason at all why one shouldn't have some part of the law introduced, and later on, when people become more familiar with that, another part of the law introduced. So I can see you can reconcile having a major new code, but introducing it bit by bit as people become more familiar with parts of it. And secondly, what is also being suggested in the law is that in the case of, say, transactions in village land by villagers who will be getting individualized tenure, they should be able to opt to decide whether to have their transaction, when they go in for transaction, governed by customary law or governed by the modern statute law, as indeed is the case where they can opt in, I think, Botswana, where people can opt which way to go. And in this way, people again can decide whether to stick with the sort of old and trusted law, which may possibly inhibit their getting, say, a credit, or whether to move to the new statute law, which might assist them to get some credit. And the new statute law will be geared not so much for the major international donors, but will be geared and hopefully drafted in such a way that it can be used by smallholder farmers.
Well, I... Okay, a very brief intervention.
Yeah, I just want to make two little comments. First one on health. And I can understand the difficulty which adult farmers have when you're choosing between too little law or too much law. But I have this fear that juridical inflation can also have its consequences that do not always work. Number one, the more law you have, the more bureaucracy you're going to need. And that raises a whole different set of questions about the capacity of a country to implement legislation. And the second one, the more law you have, also the more conflicts you're going to create and internal contradictions and a great deal more confusion than if you have little. So I think I hope that in the process of legislating for Tanzania, some of these issues are issues that will be talked through. I was involved in some way before you started the draft of the transition, and some of these things worried me tremendously. That's my first comment. The second comment relates to listening. I was in the team that worked on the compensation principles, 1988-89, and my duty was to answer precisely the issue that has come now. What do you do with a set of compensation principles that are not incorporated in the law? And we did make very detailed recommendations on the incorporation of those principles in the legislation creating the Lesotho Highlands Authority. Now, quite obviously, the legislature did not do that.
I think the first point is a perfectly fair one. Yes, I think that there is going to be a problem. If you're going to give power to officials in the village and you're going to set up a legal framework for officials in the village to exercise these powers, then you are going to have to find enormous numbers of officials. But once you decide to hand over management of land to officials in the village, whether you provide them with law or not, you are going to need more bureaucracy. And one of the complaints that came out of the Presidential Commission in Tanzania was that the peasants were fed up with being pushed about by central government officials who seemed to exercise their powers without any regard to law whatsoever. So the message from the grassroots in Tanzania was, we want some law and we want our own officials to administer our own land. And that is going to lead to an increase in the number of officials and an increase in the amount of law. In Lesotho, yes, I agree, it's a great pity, I think. They've had long enough now to introduce the very good compensation principles into the law, but for some reason they have not yet done it, and the result is, of course, that people are highly suspicious of the agency when it refuses to do that.
Well, I must apologize for cutting off what promises to be an extremely interesting discussion, but let me quickly say that there will be two other chances of carrying on with this discussion. One is, of course, the full program of events tomorrow. There are four seminars, two before lunch, two after. And registration starts in room 143 in the main building from 9:15. Those of you who are not familiar with the program can pick up a copy or arrive there and get one. You would be very welcome. The second opportunity for discussion, of course, is more immediate. You're all very cordially invited to a reception in the senior common room where we can carry on with this engaging discussion. But before I invite you to climb the stairs to the fifth floor, let me express the appreciation of the school as well as the institute to Mrs. Buckley for this opportunity that we have of engaging in debate on law and development, and also thank our speaker today, Professor Patrick Costland, for this very insightful and very thoughtful presentation, which has given us an excellent coverage of this topic. Thank you very much indeed.